From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, riot hit Ferguson sees a second night of unrest. Donetsk, Ukraine is feeling the pinch. As Ebola causes Sikh money, AIDS campaigns say they are too in need.
Funders feel that HIV is no longer a sexy disease that they can fund. However, we still have a lot of people who are dying because of AIDS-related diseases.
Is the Iran nuclear negotiations extension a step forward or a step backwards? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson saw a second night of unrest, and solidarity demonstrations were held nationwide to protest a grand jury's decision to not indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager named Michael Brown. More than 2,000 National Guard soldiers are deployed in Ferguson, Missouri, in response to riots that broke out late Monday after it was announced that charges would not be filed against Officer Darren Wilson. VOA's Aisha Tanzim, who is in Ferguson, says there has been no repeat of the widespread looting that was seen on the first night of protests when over a dozen buildings were set on fire.
One reason is that the National Guard is spread out in multiple locations. We saw them outside the police department. They were behind the police lines. They were not in front, but they were in riot gear and in riot formation. And in front of them, there was the United Command's riot formation. But they are scattered all over and guarding key areas in Ferguson and in surrounding counties.
A tense moment occurred late Tuesday when a group of protesters smashed the windows of and set fire to a police car in front of Ferguson City Hall. Tanzim says a large number of riot police and National Guard troops approached the area in armored vehicles and ordered the protesters to disperse.
They started announcing that everybody needs to leave the area right now at that moment. Somebody, we don't even know if it was the police, somebody in the crowd threw pepper spray on a whole bunch of people, including our own VOA colleague who got pepper sprayed pretty badly. And we had to immediately find medics and evacuate him and move him to safety.
Police declared the gathering to be illegal and warned that those refusing to leave would be arrested. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar said 44 people were arrested overnight, adding to the 61 that were arrested a night earlier. The shooting death in Ferguson has brought to the surface unresolved racial tensions that still exist in the United States. Zlatika Hoke has this report for VOA Television.
African-American groups nationwide have raised their voices against what they call continued racial inequality.
We can no longer just allow funeral after funeral after funeral after funeral and killing after killing after killing after killing to go on.
Demonstrations have taken place nationwide to protest the grand jury's decision. In addition to St. Louis, protesters have come out in major American cities, including New York. Many protesters say they are marching to draw attention to a wider problem.
I know that a lot of us gathered around Michael Brown, but he's one of thousands.
Students at Indiana University held a moment of silence for the shooting victim, Michael Brown.
No justice!
Some high school students in Minneapolis walked out of classes to protest the jury decision. On the West Coast, protesters in Los Angeles expressed anger at how police in this country treat African Americans in general.
Well, it's interesting. My reaction is I was not surprised. Definitely in the United States of America, white police officers are killing and white security guards are killing black individuals every 28 hours. So it was not a surprise to me. I think what's more important to me is what people out here and on the streets are prepared to do to stop the execution of black and brown bodies in our communities.
House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi expressed disappointment at the jury's decision and said more needs to be done to address the discontent of America's black people.
The reaction, obviously needs to be addressed. That is to say, there is an unhappiness, a discontent in our communities about the relationship of everyone.
It seems that more anger is directed at the law enforcement system than at the jury made up of 12 randomly selected Missouri residents.
I feel like things were thoroughly considered and that it was a just outcome.
Many Americans are calling for new regulations that would curb the police use of lethal weapons.
They have stun guns, they got the pop guns that they can use. You can protect yourself in other ways besides deadly force.
The United Nations human rights chief on Tuesday said the United States needs to examine the deep mistrust among some population segments and how race relations affect law enforcement. Slarissa Ho, VOA News, Washington.
The temperatures are plunging in southeast Ukraine, and residents of the separatist-controlled city of Donetsk are now facing an economic blockade. With banks closed, there is a shortage of cash, and pensioners are feeling the pinch most. Life is slightly easier for those who fled, but they too are scrambling to make ends meet. Jamie Detmer reports from Donetsk.
Daily life in Donetsk, which is controlled by Moscow-backed separatists, is unpredictable. Shell and rocket exchanges on the outskirts between insurgents and Ukrainian forces have a habit of overshooting. Last week, a water pump station was hit, leaving an entire district without water. What isn't unpredictable is the hardship many are facing, especially pensioners. The shops are still well stocked with food and other goods, and trucks ferry in merchandise along the main roads from outside, a trade involving kickbacks and negotiations at checkpoints. Although merchandise is still getting through, many people don't have the cash to buy. An economic blockade ordered by the government is now kicking in. Banks are closed, ATMs don't work, and the credit card networks have been cut. And the elderly can't get pensions unless they re-register in neighbouring cities and then travel there regularly to receive their money, a journey that can take 6 hours one way by bus. Many can't afford to make the journey or are too infirm. Pavel, a 76-year-old former coal miner, says the government should pay pensions and allowances. He says his wife died and he needs money to bury her, but can't get the allowance to do so. Kiev hopes the blockade will disrupt the separatists and turn ordinary people against them. Even if it does, it isn't clear how that will hasten the end of the armed insurgency. Western diplomats worry the blockade will prompt a backlash against Kiev instead and say the Ukrainian government should better explain the isolation policy. Although they don't face a risk to life and limb from artillery exchange, those who have fled Donetsk are facing tough times too. No one knows for certain how many have fled the easternmost oblasts of Donetsk and Luhansk. The UN says there are more than 400,000 displaced people, but many don't register. Only about a third of the lights are on in apartment blocks in the city of Donetsk in the evenings, and it had, before the separatist agitation, a population of 950,000. 38-year-old Vladimir fled Donetsk in June with his two children. The final straw for him was when intense fighting started up at the airport. He says the separatists started to build roadblocks, and they had heavy weapons, and he realized it wouldn't go easy. He's now living with his family in one room and wondering what is next for him. He says he doesn't know what he should do in the future. It depends on how long they'll be fighting in the east. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
With the global AIDS epidemic well into its fourth decade, organizations in Africa and elsewhere say they're worried that the Ebola virus is taking the spotlight off the far deadlier scourge of HIV and its associated ailments. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg spoke with one South African AIDS campaign.
As the Ebola virus takes more lives in West Africa and dominates headlines, Sibongile Shabalala knows the Treatment Action Campaign has run out of steam at the worst possible time. The South African AIDS advocacy group is facing imminent shutdown over a budget shortfall of about 10 million rand, about $900,000. Shabalala is the group's chairwoman for the province of Gauteng. She spoke to VOA News in Johannesburg, Gauteng's capital. Shabalala agrees that Ebola is a major problem and is worthy of attention. But she says, so is AIDS.
Ebola is a crisis that everyone must deal with. However, with the HIV funding, is the picture that our government is painting outside, in outside countries. Funders feel that HIV is no longer a sexy a disease that they can fund. However, we still have a lot of people who are dying because of AIDS-related diseases. Almost over 700 people are dying a day, of which it's too much for us to have those people who are dying every day in South Africa. That tells us that there's much lot more work to be done on HIV, and that tells us that we haven't won the fight against HIV yet.
The group now has until World AIDS Day, December 1st, to raise that money. And despite some generous pledges, is still far from that goal. Their financial crash was caused by the pullout of major foreign government sponsors, who now deem South Africa to be a middle-income nation, and therefore no longer in need. South Africa also has the world's largest AIDS medication program. Ebola is a swift killer. Many patients die in days or weeks and in horrible pain, and there is no cure. Medical advancements mean that AIDS can now be a lifelong condition instead of a death sentence. But that doesn't make AIDS any less dangerous. If Ebola maintains the pace it started at the beginning of this year, as documented by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, it may kill about 16 people on December 1st. On World AIDS Day, AIDS may kill as many as 4,400. Dr. Fru Benson, Chief Director of Communicable Diseases for South Africa's National Department of Health, says his nation has fended off Ebola before, in 1996. The first patient, a nurse, was effectively treated and did not provoke an outbreak. Benson says the same factors that are helping Ebola grow in West Africa, poor facilities, lack of sanitation, poverty, also have boosted the world's biggest killers like AIDS, TB, and malaria.
Ideally, you should have a health system that's resilient, that's strong, that is able to absorb not only one of the formidable diseases when it comes along, but even everyday diseases like hypertension, diabetes. At the moment, more people have died from these diseases in South Africa than currently in the Ebola outbreak. I think one of the biggest lessons learned is if you have a health system that's strong, that is where your investment needs to lie.
Since it was founded in 1998, the TAC has campaigned for better health facilities with moderate success, Shabalala says.
If you can go to our clinics, there is not enough infection control. The clinics are very small, and people have to go in one room, waiting room. A lot of people went there, and we don't know these people what their disease they have. If that a person with TB there will just cough, everyone who's that in that room will get infected.
Shabalala says if you are feeling generous this Christmas, a donation to the TAC won't only help those with HIV.
I'll ask them to give that money to advocate for better health services in South Africa for everyone who lives in South Africa.
At the end of the day, she says the campaigns for both of these deadly but very different diseases have the same mission, to improve services for all and save lives. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Iran and the so-called P5+1 negotiators have agreed to an extension of up to 7 months on the Iran nuclear talks, a move that could give both sides more breathing room as they try to reach consensus on Tehran's uranium enrichment levels. But analysts say the length of the deadline extension could also indicate the two sides remain far apart on core issues. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has this look at the issue.
In a Tuesday briefing, State Department spokesman Jeff Rafke said Iran nuclear negotiators are closer to a deal that would make the entire world safer and more secure. He downplayed the significance of the 7-month extension in talks.
The extension is just an extension. It does not provide additional sanctions relief for Iran.
But Atlantic Council nuclear analyst Matthew Koenig says the extension could be an indication of deadlock.
According to my sources, there's really been very little progress made.
He says all of the major issues identified a year ago are still major issues, including enrichment levels, sanctions relief, and a decision on how long a final deal would remain in place.
There's really no reason to believe that if we continue the same strategy, that we'll make any progress in the next 7 months.
Brookings Institution analyst Ricardo Alcaro says he was both surprised and disappointed by the seven-month extension, but he says the extra time could be beneficial.
For the 5+1, to keep on negotiating all things remaining the same is okay, because the alternative is much worse.
He says the prospect of a final deal is still plausible.
There is a possibility you can get to a deal. However, in terms of odds, I am more pessimistic than optimistic. I must say that.
He says Iran's president and foreign minister may be ready to strike a deal, but the country's supreme leader does not appear to be convinced. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Global oil prices steady today after falling more than 2% Tuesday, with West Texas crude for January delivery trading at about $74 a barrel. Oil has fallen about 30% in value since June amid ample global supplies. The 12-member Organization of Petroleum Exporting Nations, OPEC, meets in Vienna Thursday to discuss cutting daily production levels to below the 30 million barrel ceiling it agreed to 3 years ago. Reports indicate the cartel will hold the line on output. Carl Larry, director of oil and gas for the market research consultancy Frost & Sullivan, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, OPEC faces a real conundrum given its lost market share to the United States.
The U.S. has been increasing its oil production to nearly double in the past 2 years. And so we've backed out a lot of oil barrels from OPEC here. Then the second part that OPEC's dealing with is that the competition for the remaining clients or the main consumers in the rest of the world is shrinking. And the biggest consumer outside the U.S. is China. So OPEC's really trying to find who is going to get to that front of that line. And that's where the biggest dilemma is in this meeting. It's not so much the fact that the U.S. is producing so much more because we still import crude, but the fact is that the rest of the world is just not, you know, not consuming as much as we just saw lost from the U.S. So, you know, you have these meetings with Russia, you have these meetings with Mexico. And what OPEC is trying to do is get a gauge on who's stepping up in front of Asia and China specifically.
Saudi Arabia has been playing it close to the vest with regard to what its intentions will be at this Vienna meeting. Does Saudi Arabia drive what OPEC ultimately does?
They normally do, but the issue now is really about what is Saudi Arabia willing to give up and what are they willing to concede in terms of competition. Before, the Saudis were always trying to figure out how they can rein in the overproduction or, on the opposite end, how they can supply more to the market. Well, right now you have other countries, that, especially in OPEC, that are already under contract and supplying a lot of other people, and they want to stay in their position. They want to keep supplying who they're supplying. So if there's any cuts, the Saudis not only lose their production that they're making, but they're losing their spot in line. And that's the big trouble here that OPEC's facing. Nobody wants to give up their position within that cartel.
OPEC pumps, I guess, about a third of the world's, or provides about a third of the world's oil supply. Right now, they've limited themselves to an output quota daily of 30 million barrels for the past 3 years. Do you anticipate that to stay about the same, to drop, or to rise?
I think it's going to drop. I think they will have to make a token cut, whether it's a million barrels a day, which I think would be satisfactory, or maybe less. And the way that would be less would probably be by cutting overproduction. They know that a lot of countries are overproducing because there's been issues in the past year or so with Libya and Iran. And so everybody's trying to make up for that. But it's caused a glut. And so now they're either going to have to curb overproduction, which is going to happen regardless, or they will make this obligatory cut of a million barrels a day, and that will support the market and at least firm prices up.
Leary says an Iran nuclear agreement could result in greater oil output with Tehran, adding 1 to 2 million barrels a day to global production, while eventual approval of the XL pipeline from Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast would allow the U.S. to further reduce its reliance on OPEC imports. And Leary says a U.S. congressional hearing scheduled next month on ending a decades-old law prohibiting the U.S. from exporting crude oil appears to be the latest development in America's growing energy abundance. And as Republicans take hold of both houses of Congress in January, may eventually add even more oil to the global marketplace. Climate watchers will be focused on Lima, Peru in December as representatives of 200 countries gather for negotiations on a new climate treaty. It will replace the Kyoto Protocol, the global agreement that expired in 2012. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, hopes for success in this round of talks are boosted by recent agreements among the world's top polluters.
The meeting in Lima sets the stage for Paris in 2015, when nations will come together to agree on a binding climate treaty, says Jennifer Morgan, global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute.
That all countries would be part of, which is one of the differences of the past, and that would stick around for a while. That would be a global agreement for decades to come. That would bring countries back to the table to strengthen their commitment to solving the problem.
Scientists affirm with increased certainty that the planet is getting hotter. Study after study shows that the world is well on its way toward a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature above pre-industrial levels. Experts say that would trigger extreme weather and rising seas, problems of global magnitude. The studies also show that climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels are to blame. Lima is about getting those emissions in check. Morgan points to growing momentum to get that done. In September, the United Nations held a climate summit to engage heads of state and industry leaders, and about 700,000 people crowded streets in New York City and elsewhere for the People's Climate March.
Then bounce into European heads of state in October saying, here's our offer to reduce at least 40% emissions. And then the U.S.-China announcement recently, where those two countries came forward in a pretty historic announcement of what they're willing to do on their numbers and their willingness to work together.
In that agreement between the world's top polluters, the U.S. committed to reducing emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And for the first time, China put a timetable on its actions, saying emissions would peak by 2030. Morgan says to get there, China must begin making massive cuts now.
It's not like they're going to wait 16 years. They actually have to shut down coal-fired power plants. They have to build up renewable energy. They have to be much more efficient in order to turn that curve.
The deal puts China in a leadership role for the first time. Other countries are expected to put their reduced emissions commitments on the table by March. Morgan says the U.S.-China announcement is a strategic move that could energize other nations to do more.
If you look at developed countries, it's fair to say that Australia or Canada haven't indicated when they are going to table their offer. Well, if China can offer something, certainly they can offer something too. And in developing countries, I think a country like India or Brazil, I think now are challenged to table their offers as well.
Morgan says it's critical to close the emissions gap between what is needed and what countries are expected to pledge. She says each nation will make reductions in its own way through national policies and laws, but only a global pact with binding commitments can exert pressure to get the job done.
So it's in the interest of every country to actually have a global approach so that they can be sure that what they're doing is being mirrored by others. You don't get that through bilateral deals. You don't get all of the emissions in place, and you don't take care of the most vulnerable countries around the world adequately. So you need to do this global. It's challenging, it's messy, but it's fundamental to move forward.
Morgan hopes that the Lima meeting will end with a text for a new treaty, one that will guide negotiators and lead governments to act. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
And I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Hope you'll join us again. And for you Americans, happy Thanksgiving tomorrow.